development of this skill at the factory, an open space where apes bring their nuts to anvil stones and fill the jungle with a steady rhythm of banging noise. Youngsters hang around the hard-working adults, occasionally pilfering kernels from their mothers. This way they learn the taste of nuts, as well as the connection with stones. They make hundreds of futile attempts, hitting the nuts with their hands and feet, or aimlessly pushing nuts and stones around. That they still learn the skill is a great testament to the irrelevance of reinforcement, because none of these activities is ever rewarded until, by about 3 years of age, the juvenile starts to coordinate to the point that a nut is occasionally cracked. It is only by the age of 6 or 7 that their skill reaches adult level. When it comes to tool use, chimps always catch the limelight. But there are 3 other great apes, bonobos, gorillas, and orangutans, that, together with chimps, us, and the gibbons, make up the hominoid family. Not to be confused with monkeys, hominoids are large, flat-chested primates without tails. Within this family, we are closest to chimps and bonobos, both of which are genetically nearly identical to us. Naturally, there is heated debate about what the minuscule-sounding 1.2% DNA difference between us and them exactly means, but that we are close family is not in doubt. In captivity, the orangutan is an absolute master tool user, dexterous enough to tie knots into loose shoelaces and to construct instruments. One young male was seen to join 3 sticks, which he had first sharpened into 2 tubes to build a 5-section pole to knock down suspended food. Being notorious escape artists, orangs may dismantle their cage so patiently from day to day and week to week, while keeping dislodged screws and bolts out of sight, that keepers fail to notice what they are doing until it's too late. In contrast, until recently, all we knew about wild orangs was that they sometimes scratched their butt with a stick or held a leafy branch over their head during rain. How could a species that is so talented offer so little evidence of tool use in the wild? The inconsistency was resolved when, in 1999, the tool technology of orangutans in a Sumatran peat swamp came to light. These orangs extract honey from bee nests with twigs and use short sticks to remove the seeds embedded in the stinging hairs of Nessia fruits. The other ape species, too, are perfectly capable of tool use, and we have already laid to rest the view that gibbons lack this capacity. But reports from the wild remain meager to non-existent, sometimes suggesting that only chimps are proficient tool users. We see glimpses, such as when gorillas preventively disarm poacher snares, which requires a grasp of basic mechanics, or traverse deep water. When elephants had dug a new water hole in a swampy forest in the Republic of Congo, the German primatologist Thomas Breuer saw a female gorilla, Leah, try to wade across. She stopped when she was waist-deep into it, however. Apes hate swimming. Leah returned to shore to pick up a long branch to gauge the water's depth. Feeling around with her stick, she walked bipedally far into the pool before retracing her steps to return to her wailing infant. This example highlights the shortcomings of Beck's classical definition, because even though Leah's stick altered neither anything in the environment nor her own position, it did serve as a tool. Chimpanzees are recognized as the most versatile primate tool user, apart from us. But this heralded position has been challenged. The challenge did not come from any hominoid, but from a small South American monkey. Brown capuchin monkeys have been known for centuries as organ grinders, and more recently as trained helping hands for quadriplegics. They are extremely manipulative and particularly good at tasks that tap into their tendency to smash and bang things. Having had a colony of these monkeys for decades, I know that almost anything you hand them, a piece of carrot, an onion, is going to be pounded to mush on the floor or against the wall. In the wild, they pound oysters for a long time until the mollusk relaxes its muscle so they can pry it open. During the fall, our monkeys in Atlanta collected so many fallen hickory nuts from nearby trees that we'd hear frantic banging sounds the whole day in our office adjacent to the monkey area. It was a happy sound, because capuchins seem to be in their best mood when they're doing things. Not only did they try to break open the nuts, they also employed hard objects, a plastic toy, a block of wood, to smash them with. About half the members of one group learned to do so, whereas the second group never invented the technique, despite having the same nuts and tools. This group obviously consumed fewer nuts. Capuchins' natural predisposition to be persistent pounders sets them up for nutcracking in the field. A Spanish naturalist first reported it 5 centuries ago, and more recently an international team of scientists found dozens of cracking sites in the Tietê Ecological Park and other sites in Brazil. At one site, capuchins eat the pulp of a large fruit, after which they drop its seeds to the ground. They return a couple of days later to collect those seeds, which by then have dried out and are often infested with larvae, which the monkeys are fond of. Traveling with the seeds stuffed in their hands, mouth, and prehensile tail in search of a hard surface, such as a large rock, the monkeys would get a smaller stone to pound the seeds with. While these stones are about the same size as those used by chimps, the capuchins are only about the size of a small cat, so their hammers weigh about one-third of their body. Literally acting as heavy equipment operators, they lift them high above their heads to get a good hit. When the tough seeds are cracked, the larvae are there for the picking. Capuchin nutcracking thoroughly upset the evolutionary narrative that had been woven around humans and apes. According to this story, we are not the only ones who knew a Stone Age. Our closest relatives still live in one. To stress this point, a percussive stone technology site, including stone assemblies and the remains of smashed nuts, was excavated in a tropical forest in Ivory Coast, where chimpanzees must have been opening nuts for at least 4,000 years. These discoveries led to a human-ape-lithic cultural story that fit together nicely, tying us to our close relatives. This is why the discovery of similar behavior in a more distant relative, such as the capuchin monkey, equipped with tails by which they can hang, was met with surprise and initial grumbling. The monkeys didn't fit. The more we learned, however, the more the nutcracking by capuchins in Brazil began to resemble that of chimpanzees in West Africa. Yet capuchins belonged to the neotropical monkeys, a distant group that split off 30 to 40 million years ago from the rest of the primate order. Perhaps the similar tool use was a case of convergent evolution, since both chimps and capuchins are extractive foragers. They break things open, destroy outer shells, and smash things to pulp in order to eat, which might be the context in which their high intelligence evolved. On the other hand, since both are large-brained primates with binocular vision and manipulative hands, there is an undeniably evolutionary connection. The distinction between homology and analogy is not always as clear as we'd like it to be. To complicate matters, the tool use of capuchins and chimpanzees may not be cognitively at the same level. Over many years of working with both species, I have formed a distinct impression of how they go about their business, which I'll offer here in everyday language. Chimpanzees, like all the apes, think before they act. The most deliberate ape is perhaps the orangutan, but chimps and bonobos, despite their emotional excitability, also judge a situation before tackling it, weighing the effect of their actions. They often find solutions in their heads rather than having to try things out. Sometimes we see a combination of both, as when they start acting on a plan before it is completely formed, which is, of course, not unusual in our species either. In contrast, the capuchin monkey is a frenzied trial-and-error machine. These monkeys are hyperactive, hyper-manipulative, and afraid of nothing. They try out a great variety of manipulations and possibilities, and once they discover something that works, they instantly learn from it. They don't mind making tons of mistakes, and rarely give up. There is not much pondering and thinking behind their behavior. They are overwhelmingly action-driven. Even if these monkeys often end up with the same solutions as the apes, they seem to get there in an entirely different way. While all this may be a gross simplification, it is not without experimental support. An Italian primatologist, Elisabetta Visalberghi, has spent a lifetime studying the tool use of brown capuchins at her facility adjoining the Rome Zoo. In one illuminating experiment, a monkey faced a horizontal, transparent tube with a peanut visible in the center. The plastic tube was mounted so that the peanut was at monkey eye level. The monkey couldn't get to it, though, since the tube was too narrow and long. Many objects were available to push the food out, ranging from the most suitable, a long stick, to the least, short sticks, soft, flexible rubber. The capuchins made an astonishing number of errors, such as hitting the tube with the stick, vigorously shaking the tube, pushing the wrong material into one end, or pushing short sticks into both ends so that the peanut couldn't budge. The monkeys learned over time, however, and began to prefer the long stick. At this point, Visalberghi added an ingenious twist by making a hole in the tube. Now it suddenly mattered which way the peanut was pushed. Pushed toward the hole, the peanut would fall into a small plastic container and be lost to the monkey. Would capuchin monkeys understand the need to stay clear of the trap, and would they do so right away, or only after many failed attempts? Handing four monkeys a long stick to work on the trap tube, three performed at random, being successful half the time, which they seemed perfectly happy with. But not Roberta, a slender young female who kept trying and trying. She'd push the stick into the left end of the tube, then race around to see how it and the peanut looked from the right end. Then she'd switch sides, inserting the stick into the right end, only to race around to peek into the tube from the left. She kept going back and forth, sometimes failing, sometimes succeeding, but in the end becoming quite successful. How had Roberta solved the problem? The investigators concluded that she'd followed a simple rule of thumb. Insert the stick into the end of the tube farthest away from the reward. This way the peanut could be pushed out without having to cross the trap. They tested it out in several ways, one of which was to offer Roberta a new plastic tube without any trap at all. Now she could push the stick whichever way she wanted and be successful. She kept racing around the tube, however, looking for the longest distance from the peanut, insisting on the rule that had been the key to her success. Since Roberta acted as if the trap were still there, she clearly had not paid much attention to how it worked. Visalberghi concluded that monkeys are able to solve the trap tube task without actually understanding it. This task may look simple, yet it is harder than it seems. Human children solve it reliably only when they are over 3 years old. Testing five chimpanzees on the same problem, two of them grasped the cause and effect relation and learned to specifically avoid the trap. While Roberta had merely learned which actions led to success, the apes recognized how the trap worked. They were representing the connections between actions, tools, and outcomes in their heads. This is known as a representational mental strategy, which allows solutions before action. This difference may seem minor, since both monkeys and apes solved the problem, but it is actually huge. The level at which apes understand the purpose of tools affords them incredible flexibility. The richness of their technology, the toolkits, and the frequent tool-making all prove that higher cognition helps. The American primate expert William Mason concluded in the 1970s that evolution has endowed the hominoids with a cognition that sets them apart from the other primates, so that an ape is best described as a thinking being. The ape structures the world in which it lives, giving order and meaning to its environment, which is clearly reflected in its actions. It is not very illuminating, perhaps, to describe a chimpanzee as figuring out how to proceed while it sits and stares at the problem before it. Certainly such an assertion lacks originality as well as precision. But we cannot escape the inference that some such process is at work, and that it has a significant effect on the ape's performance. It seems better to be vaguely correct than positively wrong. Here come the crows. I first encountered the tube task during a visit to the Jigokudani Monkey Park in Japan, in one of the world's coldest habitats with native primates. Tourist guides use the task to demonstrate monkey intelligence. At the feeding site next to the river, which attracts snow monkeys from the surrounding montane forest, a horizontal transparent tube was baited with a piece of sweet potato. Rather than wielding a stick like the Capuchins, one female snow monkey pushed her small infant into the tube while firmly holding onto its tail. The baby crawled toward the food and grabbed it, only to be quickly withdrawn by its loving mom, who pried the prize from its resistant clutch. Another female collected rocks to throw into one end of the tube, so that the food came out the other end. These are macaques, monkeys much closer to us than capuchins. The most spectacular evidence for macaque tool use has been collected by Michael Gummert, an American primatologist. On Phyak Nam Yai Island, off the coast of Thailand, Gummert found an entire population of long-tailed macaques using stone tools. I am very familiar with this species, having done my dissertation on them. Also known as crab-eating macaques, these smart monkeys are rumored to hang their long tails in water to pull up crabs. I have seen them use their tail almost like a stick to obtain food. Unable to control it, as South American primates do, a macaque's tail is non-prehensile. They grab their tail with one hand and swap food from outside to inside their cage with it. Manipulating one's own body appendage is yet another example that stretches the definition of tool use, but there is no doubt that what Gummert discovered is a well-developed technology. His monkeys on the coast collect stones every day for two purposes. Bigger stones serve as hammers to pound oysters with blunt force until they break open, revealing a delicious, rich food source. Smaller stones are used rather like axes, applying a precision grip and more rapid movements in order to dislodge shellfish from rocks. During the few hours of ebb tide, both food and tools are abundant. An ideal situation for the invention of this seafood technology. It is testimony to the generalized intelligence of primates, because obviously they evolved in the trees, eating fruits and leaves, but here they were surviving on the beach. After humans, chimps, and capuchins, a fourth primate has entered the Stone Age. Beyond the primates, however, there are quite a few tool-using mammals and birds. Coastal Californians can watch their own floating technology every day among the kelp. The popular furry sea otter swims on his back while using both front paws to smash shellfish against a stone anvil on his chest. He also hammers abalones with a large rock to dislodge them, taking multiple dives to finish this underwater job. A close relative of the otter may possess even more spectacular talents. The honey badger is the star of a viral YouTube video full of expletives to indicate how badass this Chuck Norris of the animal kingdom is. The species is even featured on T-shirts emblazoned with "Honey Badger Don't Care." This so-called badger is a small carnivore, which actually, like the otter, belongs to the weasel family. While I know of no official reports about their skills, A recent PBS documentary features a rescued honey badger named Stoffel, who invents multiple ways to escape from his enclosure at a South African rehabilitation center. Assuming that what we see is not a trained trick, he outwits his human caretakers at every turn and displays the sort of insight for his Houdini act that one might expect from an ape, not a honey badger. The documentary shows Stoffel leaning a rake against the wall and claims that he once piled up large stones against it to escape. After all the stones were removed from his enclosure, he apparently constructed a heap of mud balls for the same purpose. Even though all this is most impressive and begs for further investigation, the greatest challenge to the supremacy of primates has come not from other mammals, but from a flock of squawking and cawing birds that landed right in the midst of the tool debate. They caused about as much mayhem as they did in that Hitchcock movie. During the quiet hours in his pet store, my grandfather patiently trained goldfinches to pull a string. This particular finch is known in Dutch as a poedertje, a name that refers to the drawing of water from a well. Males that could both sing and draw would fetch a high price. For centuries, these little colorful birds were kept in homes with a chain around their leg, pulling a thimble up from a glass so as to fetch their own drinking water. One such finch is featured in the 17th century Dutch painting central to Donna Tartt's novel, The Goldfinch. Of course, we don't keep these birds anymore, at least not in this cruel fashion. But their traditional trick is very similar to the one that in 2002 gave us Betty the Crow. In an aviary at Oxford University, Betty was trying to pull a little bucket out of a transparent vertical pipe. In the bucket was a small piece of meat, and next to the pipe were two tools for her to choose from. One was a straight wire, the other a hooked one. Only with the latter could Betty get a hold of the bucket's handle. After her companion stole the hooked wire, however, she faced the task with an inappropriate tool. Undeterred, Betty used her beak to bend the straight wire into a hook so as to pull the bucket from the tube. This remarkable feat was a mere anecdote until perceptive scientists systematically investigated it with new tools. In subsequent tests, Betty received only straight wires, which she kept subjecting to her remarkable bending act. Apart from dispelling the bird brain notion with which birds are unfairly saddled, Betty achieved instant fame by giving us the first laboratory proof of tool making outside the primate order. I add laboratory because Betty's species in the wild, in the Southwest Pacific, was already known for tool crafting. New Caledonian crows spontaneously modify branches until they have a little wooden hook to fish grubs out of crevices. The ancient Greek poet Aesop may have had an inkling of these talents, given his fable The Crow and the Pitcher. A crow, half dead with thirst, so the fabulist went, came upon a pitcher. There wasn't enough water in the pitcher for the crow to be able to drink it. He tried to reach in with his beak, but the water level was too low. Then a thought came to him, as Aesop put it, and he took a pebble and dropped it into the pitcher. Many more pebbles followed until the water had risen enough for a drink. It seems an unlikely feat, but it has now been replicated in the lab. The first was an experiment on rooks, a corvid that in the wild does not use any tools. The rooks were presented with a vertical water-filled tube with a floating mealworm just out of reach. The water level would have to be raised if the rook were to reach the delicacy. The same experiment was carried out with New Caledonian crows, known as real tool experts. True to the dictum that necessity is the mother of invention, and confirming Aesop's story several millennia later, both crow species successfully solved the floating worm puzzle by using pebbles to raise the water level in the tube. Let me add some caution, though, because it is unclear how insightful this solution was. For one thing, all the birds had been pre-trained using a slightly different task. They had received ample rewards for plunging stones into a tube. Moreover, while they were facing the tube with the mealworm, stones had been conveniently placed right next to it. The experimental setup strongly suggested the solution, therefore. Imagine that Cooler had taught his chimps to stack boxes. We would never have heard of him, as it would have undermined any claims of insight. In the course of testing, the crows did learn that large stones work better than small ones, and that there is no point dropping stones into a pipe filled with sawdust. Rather than working these answers out in their minds, however, it may have been a matter of fast learning. Perhaps they noticed that adding stones to water brought the mealworm closer, which led them to persist. When we recently presented our chimpanzees with a floating peanut task, a female named Liza solved it right away, adding water to a plastic tube. After some vigorous but ineffective kicking and shaking of the tube, Liza abruptly turned around, went to the drinker to fill her mouth, and returned to the tube to add water. She made several more trips to the drinker before she got the peanut at the right level to reach it with her fingers. Other chimps were less successful, but one female tried to pee into the tube. She had the right idea, even though the execution was flawed. I have known Liza all her life, and am sure that this problem was brand new to her. Our experiment was inspired by a floating peanut task conducted on a large number of orangutans and chimpanzees, a subset of which cracked the puzzle at first sight. This is especially remarkable, since, unlike the crows, the apes had no pre-training, nor did they find any tools nearby. Rather, they must have conjured the effectiveness of water in their heads before going out of their way to collect it. Water doesn't even look like a tool. How hard this task is became clear from tests on children, many of which never found the solution. Only 58% of 8-year-olds came up with it, and only 8% of 4-year-olds. Most children frantically try to reach the prize with their fingers, then give up. These studies have set up a friendly rivalry between primate chauvinists and corvid aficionados. I sometimes teasingly accuse the latter of ape envy, because in every publication they draw a contrast with the primates, saying the corvids are either doing better or at least equally well. Calling their birds feathered apes, they make outrageous claims such as, "The only credible evidence of technological evolution in non-humans to date comes from New Caledonian crows." Primatologists, on the other hand, wonder how generalizable corvid tool skills are, and if feathered monkeys isn't a better moniker for the birds. Are crows one-trick ponies, like the clam-smashing otters or the Egyptian vultures that throw rocks at ostrich eggs? Or do they have the intelligence to take on a broad array of problems? This issue is far from settled, because even though ape intelligence has been studied for over a century, corvid tool studies have come up only in the last decade. An intriguing new entry is the use of meta-tools by New Caledonian crows. A crow is presented with a piece of meat that it can retrieve only by using a long stick, but this stick is behind bars wide enough for the crow's beak, but not its head. The crow is unable to reach the tool. In a nearby box, however, lies a short stick suitable for retrieving the long one. To solve this problem, the right order is to pick up the short stick, use it to fetch the long one, and then apply the latter stick for the meat. The crow needs to understand that tools can be used on non-food objects and to take steps in the right order. Alex Taylor and co-workers used wild New Caledonian crows on Maury Island, placed temporarily in an aviary. They tested 7 crows, all of which managed meta-tool use. 3 followed the right sequence on the first attempt. Presently, Taylor is trying out tasks with even more steps, and the crows are keeping up with the challenge. This is most impressive, and considerably better than monkeys, which have trouble with stepwise tasks. Given the evolutionary gulf between primates and corvids, and the many ancestral species of mammals and birds in between that don't use tools, we are dealing with a typical example of convergent evolution. Independently, both taxonomic groups must have faced a need for complex manipulations of items in their environment or other challenges that stimulated brain growth, which led them to evolve strikingly similar cognitive skills. The arrival of corvids on the scene illustrates how discoveries of mental life ripple across the animal kingdom, a process best summarized by what I'll call my cognitive ripple rule. Every cognitive capacity that we discover is going to be older and more widespread than initially thought. This is rapidly becoming one of the best-supported tenets of evolutionary cognition. As a case in point, we now have evidence of tool use outside mammals and birds. Primates and corvids may well show the most sophisticated use of technology, but what to think of partially submerged crocodiles and alligators balancing large sticks on their snouts? Crocodilians do so, especially in pools and swamps near rookeries, during the nesting season, when herons and other wading birds are in desperate need of sticks and twigs. You can imagine the scene. A heron lands on a log in the water from which it wants to pick up an attractive branch, but suddenly the log comes to life and grabs the bird. Perhaps crocs initially learned that birds land on them when branches float nearby, and then extend this association by making sure to be near branches when herons are nesting. From there, it may be a small step to cover oneself with objects that attract birds. The problem with this idea, however, is that there are actually very few free-floating branches and twigs around. There is too much demand for them. Is it possible that the crocs, which the scientists lament are historically taken to be lethargic, stupid, and boring, bring their stick lures with them from far away? This would be another spectacular cognitive ripple, one that extends deliberate tool use to the reptiles. The final example, which may again stretch the definition of a tool, concerns the veined octopus in the seas around Indonesia. Here we are dealing with an invertebrate, a mollusk. It has been seen collecting coconut shells. Since octopuses are a favorite food of many predators, camouflage is one of their main goals in life. Initially, the coconut shells yield no benefit, however, because they have to be transported, which only draws unwanted attention. Stretching its arms into rigid limbs, the octopus tiptoes over the seafloor while holding its prize in some of its other arms. Awkwardly walking to a safe lair, it can then use the shells to hide underneath. A mollusk collecting tools for future protection, however simple, goes to show how far we have come since the days when technology was thought to be the defining characteristic of our species. Chapter 4. Talk to Me. Speak, and I shall baptize thee, French bishop to a chimpanzee, early 1700s. We associate research in the natural habitat with sacrifice and bravery, since field workers must tackle the unpleasant and dangerous creatures of the tropical rainforest, from blood-sucking leeches to predators and snakes. By contrast, students of captive animals are thought to have it easy. But we sometimes forget how much courage it takes to defend one's ideas in the face of staunch opposition. Most of the time this occurs just among academics, which is disagreeable rather than hazardous, but Nadia Coates faced lethal risks. Her full name was Nadezhda Nikolaevna Ladiginya Coates, and she lived and worked early last century in the shadow of the Kremlin. Under the sinister influence of the would-be geneticist Trofim Lysenko, Joseph Stalin had many a brilliant Russian biologist either shot or sent to the gulag for thinking the wrong thoughts. Lysenko believed that plants and animals pass on traits gained during their lifetime. The names of those who disagreed with him became unmentionable, and entire research institutes were closed down. It was in this oppressive climate that Coates, with her husband Alexander Fyodorovich Coates, founding director of Moscow's State Darwin Museum, set out to study ape facial expressions, inspired by the expression of the emotions in man and animals by that bourgeois Englishman Charles Darwin. Lysenko was distinctly ambivalent about Darwin's theory, some of which he labeled reactionary. Staying out of trouble became a major preoccupation of the Coateses, who hid documents and data among their taxidermy collection in the museum basement. They wisely put a large statue of the French biologist Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, famous proponent of the inheritance of acquired characteristics, at the museum entrance. Coates published in French, German, and most of all her native Russian. She wrote 7 books, of which only one was translated into English, long after its appearance in 1935. The English version of Infant, Chimpanzee, and Human Child, edited by me, appeared in 2002. The book compares the emotional life and intelligence of a young chimpanzee, Yanni, with that of Coates's little son, Rudy. Coates studied Yanni's reactions to pictures of chimpanzees and other animals, and to his own mirror image. Even though Yanni was probably too young to recognize himself, Coates describes how he would entertain himself in front of his reflection by pulling weird faces and sticking out his tongue. Coates is little known compared to Wolfgang Kühler, who conducted his groundbreaking ape research from 1912 through 1920. I wonder what she knew about it while working in Moscow from 1913 until Yanni's premature death in 1916. While Kühler is widely recognized as a pioneer of evolutionary cognition, pictures of Coates's work leave little doubt that she was on exactly the same track. One of the museum's glass cases features Yanni's mounted body surrounded by ladders and tools, including sticks that fit into each other. Was Coates overlooked by science due to her gender, or was it her language? I learned about her from the writings of Robert Yerkes, who came to Moscow to discuss her projects through an interpreter. In his books, Yerkes described Coates's work with the greatest admiration. There is a good chance, for example, that Coates invented the matching-to-sample MTS paradigm, a staple of modern cognitive neuroscience. MTS is nowadays being applied to both humans and animals in countless laboratories. Coates would hold up an object for Yanni, then hide it among other objects in a sack, and let him feel around to find the first one. The test involved 2 modalities, vision and touch, demanding that Yanni make a choice based on his memory of the previously seen model. My own fascination with this unsung hero's work took me to Moscow, too. I received a behind-the-scenes tour of the museum, where I leafed through private picture albums. Coates was, and is, much beloved in her country, where she is widely recognized as the great scientist that she was. My biggest surprise was to learn that she owned at least 3 large parrots. Pictures show her accepting an object handed to her by a cockatoo, and her holding out a tray with 3 cups toward a macaw. The parrots would sit opposite her on a table, while Coates held a small food reward in one hand and a pencil in the other, scoring their choices as she tested their ability to discriminate among objects. I checked with our contemporary expert on citiciformes, the American psychologist Irene Pepperberg, but she had never heard of Coates's parrot studies. I doubt that anyone in the West ever suspected that bird cognition, too, was studied in Russia well before it became more widely known. Alex the Parrot. I first met Alex, an African gray that Irene raised and studied for 3 decades, on visits to her department from a nearby university. Irene had bought the bird in a pet store in 1977 and was setting up an ambitious project that would open the public eye to the avian mind. It ended up paving the way for all subsequent studies of bird intelligence, because until then the general opinion had been that bird brains simply don't support advanced cognition. Due to their lack of much of anything that looks like a mammalian cortex, birds were viewed as well endowed with instincts, yet poor at learning, let alone thinking. Despite the fact that their brains can be quite sizable, the African grays is the size of a shelled walnut, with a large area that functions like a cerebral cortex, and that their natural behavior offers ample reason to question the low opinion of them, the different brain organization of birds has been held against them. Having myself kept and studied jackdaws, members of that other large-brained bird family, the corvids, I have never had any doubt about their behavioral flexibility. On walks through the park, my birds would tease dogs by flying right in front of their heads, just out of reach of their snapping mouths, to the surprise and chagrin of the dog owners. Indoors, they would play object hiding with me. I would hide a small item, such as a cork, under a pillow or behind a flower pot, while they would try to find it, or vice versa. This game relied on the well-known food-caching talents of crows and jays, but also suggested object permanence, the understanding that an object continues to exist even after it has disappeared from view. The extreme playfulness of my jackdaws hinted, as it does with animals in general, at high intelligence and the thrill of a challenge. Visiting Irene, I was quite prepared to be impressed by a bird, therefore, and Alex did not disappoint. Cockily sitting on his perch, he had begun to learn labels for items such as keys, triangles, and squares, saying key, three-corner, or four-corner whenever these objects were pointed out. At first sight, this came across as language learning, but I am not sure this is the right interpretation. Irene didn't claim that Alex's talking amounted to speaking in the linguistic sense. But of course the labeling of objects is very much part of language, and we should not forget that once upon a time, linguists defined language simply as symbolic communication. Only when apes proved capable of such communication did they feel the need to raise the bar and add refinements such as that language requires syntax and recursivity. Language acquisition by animals became a huge topic that drew enormous public interest. It was as if all questions about human intelligence boiled down to a sort of Turing test. Can we, humans, hold a sensible conversation with them? Language is such a marker of humanity that an 18th century French bishop was ready to baptize an ape, provided he could speak. It surely was all that science seemed to care about in the 1960s and 1970s, resulting in attempts to talk with dolphins and teach language to a multitude of primates. Some of this attention turned sour, however, when the American psychologist Herbert Terrace in 1979 published a highly skeptical article about the sign language capacities of Nim Chimpsky, a chimpanzee named after American linguist Noam Chomsky. Terrace found Nim a boring conversationalist. The vast majority of his utterances were requests for desirable outcomes, such as food, rather than expressions of thoughts, opinions, or ideas. Terrace's surprise at this was by itself rather surprising, however, given his reliance on operant conditioning. Since this is not how we teach children language, one wonders why it was used for an ape. Having been rewarded thousands of times for hand signals, why wouldn't Nim use these signals to obtain rewards? He simply did what he was taught. As a result of this project, however, the voices pro and contra animal language were getting louder by the day. To find a bird voice among this cacophony threw many people off, because while apes obviously don't talk, Alex carefully pronounced every word. Superficially, his behavior resembled language more than that of any other animal, even if there was little agreement about what it actually meant. Irene's choice of species was intriguing, since Dr. Doolittle, the central character of a series of children's books, owned an African gray named Polynesia, who taught the good doctor the language of animals. Irene had always been attracted to these stories, and as a child already presented her pet budgie with a drawer full of buttons to see how the bird would arrange them. Her work with Alex grew straight out of her early captivation with birds and their taste in colors and shapes. But before discussing her research further, let me briefly dwell on the desire to talk with animals, a desire often expressed by scientists working on animal cognition, as it relates to the deeper connection, often assumed between cognition and language. Oddly enough, this particular desire must have passed me by, because I have never felt it. I am not waiting to hear what my animals have to say about themselves, taking the rather Wittgensteinian position that their message might not be all that enlightening. Even with respect to my fellow humans, I am dubious that language tells us what is going on in their heads. I am surrounded by colleagues who study members of our species by presenting them with questionnaires. They trust the answers they receive and have ways, they assure me, of checking their veracity. But who says that what people tell us about themselves reveals actual emotions and motivations? This may be true for simple attitudes free from moralizations. What is your favorite music? But it seems almost pointless to ask people about their love life, eating habits, or treatment of others. Are you pleasant to work with? It is far too easy to invent post hoc reasons for one's behavior, to be silent about one's sexual habits, to downplay excessive eating or drinking, or to present oneself as more admirable than one really is. No one is going to admit to murderous thoughts, stinginess, or being a jerk. People lie all the time. So why would they stop in front of a psychologist who writes down everything they say? In one study, female college students reported more sex partners when they were hooked up to a fake lie detector machine than without it, thus demonstrating that they had been lying before. I am, in fact, relieved to work with subjects that don't talk. I don't need to worry about the truth of their utterances. Instead of asking them how often they engage in sex, I just count the occasions. I am perfectly happy being an animal watcher. Now that I think of it, my distrust of language goes even deeper, because I am also unconvinced of its role in the thinking process. I'm not sure that I think in words, and I never seem to hear any inner voices. This caused a bit of an embarrassment once in a meeting about the evolution of conscience, when fellow scholars kept referring to an inner voice that tells us what is right and wrong. "I am sorry," I said, "but I never hear such voices. Am I a man without a conscience, or do I, as the American animal expert Temple Grandin once famously said about herself, think in pictures? Moreover, which language are we talking about? Speaking two languages at home and a third one at work, my thinking must be awfully muddled. Yet I have never noticed any effect, despite the widespread assumption that language is at the root of human thought." In his 1973 presidential address to the American Philosophical Association, tellingly entitled Thoughtless Brutes, the American philosopher Norman Malcolm stated that the relationship between language and thoughts must be so close that it is really senseless to conjecture that people may not have thoughts, and also senseless to conjecture that animals may have thoughts. Since we routinely express ideas and feelings in language, we may be forgiven for assigning a role to it. But isn't it remarkable how often we struggle to find our words? It's not that we don't know what we thought or felt, but we just can't put our verbal finger on it. This would, of course, be wholly unnecessary if thoughts and feelings were linguistic products to begin with. In that case, we'd expect a waterfall of words. It is now widely accepted that even though language assists human thinking by providing categories and concepts, it is not the stuff of thought. We don't actually need language in order to think. The Swiss pioneer of cognitive development, Jean Piaget, most certainly was not ready to deny thought to preverbal children, which is why he declared cognition to be independent of language. With animals, the situation is similar. As the chief architect of the modern concept of mind, the American philosopher Jerry Fodor put it, "The obvious, and I should have thought sufficient, refutation of the claim that natural languages are the medium of thought is that there are nonverbal organisms that think." What irony. We have traveled all the way from the absence of language as an argument against thought in other species to the position that the manifest thinking by non-linguistic creatures argues against the importance of language. While I won't complain about this turn of events, it owes a great debt to language studies on animals such as Alex. Not so much because these studies demonstrated language per se, but because they helped expose animal thought in a format that we easily relate to. We see a sharp-looking bird who replies when spoken to, pronouncing object names with great accuracy. He faces a tray full of objects, some made of wool, some of wood, some of plastic, representing all colors of the rainbow. He is invited to feel every object with his beak and tongue, and then, after they have all been returned to the tray, he is asked what the two-cornered blue object is made of. By correctly answering wool, he combines his knowledge of color, shape, and material with his memory of what this particular item felt like. Or he sees two keys, one made of green plastic, the other of metal, and is asked, "What is different?" He says, "Color." Asked, "Which color bigger?" He answers, "Green." Anyone watching Alex perform, as I did in the early stages of his career, is blown away. Obviously, skeptics tried to ascribe his skills to rote learning. But since the stimuli changed all the time, as did the questions asked, it is hard to see how he could have performed at this level based on stock answers. He would have needed a gigantic memory to handle all possibilities, so much so that it is in fact simpler to assume, as Irene did, that he had acquired a few basic concepts and was capable of mentally combining them. Furthermore, he didn't need Irene's presence to answer. Nor did he even need to see the actual items. In the absence of any corn, he might be asked what color corn is, and would say yellow. Particularly impressive was Alex's ability to distinguish same from different, which required him to compare objects on a variety of dimensions. All these capacities, labeling, comparing, and judging color, shape, and material, were assumed to require language at the time that Alex began his training. It was an aggravating struggle for Irene to convince the world of his skills, especially since skepticism with respect to birds ran so much deeper than it ever was for our close relatives, the primates. After years of persistence and solid data, however, she had the satisfaction of seeing Alex turn into a celebrity. Upon his death in 2007, he was honored with obituaries in both the New York Times and The Economist. In the meantime, some of his relatives had begun to impress as well. Another African gray not only mimicked sounds, but added accompanying body movements. He'd say "ciao" while waving goodbye with a foot or wing, or say "look at my tongue" while sticking out his tongue, just as his owner had shown him. It remained a puzzle how a bird was able to draw such parallels between the human body and its own. Then there was Figaro, a Goffin's cockatoo who was seen breaking off large splinters from a wooden beam in order to rake in nuts placed outside his aviary. Before Figaro, there had been no reports of tool-making parrots. It makes me wonder if Coates ever conducted similar experiments on her cockatoo, macaw, and era. Given her keen interest in tools and her 6 untranslated books, I wouldn't be surprised to hear about it one day. There is obviously still much to discover, as also became clear from tests of Alex's counting abilities. Alex's talents were accidentally revealed while researchers were testing Griffin, a parrot named after Donald Griffin, who was staying in the same room with him. In order to see if Griffin could pair quantities with sounds, they would click twice, to which the right answer would be 2. But when Griffin failed to answer and got 2 more clicks, Alex, from across the room, chimed in with 4. And after 2 more clicks, Alex said 6, while Griffin remained mute. Alex was familiar with numbers and could correctly answer the question, "What number is green?" after having seen a tray with many objects, including several green ones. But now he was doing addition. And more than that, he was doing it without visual input. Again, adding up numbers was once thought to be language-dependent, but this claim had already begun to wobble a few years back when a chimpanzee succeeded at it. Irene set out to test Alex's capacities more systematically by placing a few differently sized items, such as pasta pieces, under a cup. She'd lift the cup up for a few seconds in front of Alex, then put it down again. After this, she would do the same for a second cup, then a third. The number of items under each cup was small, and sometimes there were none. After this, with only the 3 cups visible, Alex would be asked, "How many total?" Out of 10 tests, Alex mentioned the correct total 8 times. The 2 that he missed, he got right the second time he heard the question. And all this in his head, because he couldn't see the actual items. Unfortunately, this study was broken off by Alex's unexpected death. But by then, this diminutive mathematical genius in a gray suit had given us ample evidence that there is more knocking around in a bird's skull than anyone had suspected. Irene concluded that for far too long, animals in general, and birds in particular, have been denigrated and treated merely as creatures of instinct rather than as sentient beings. Red herring. At times, Alex's talking made perfect linguistic sense. For example, once when Irene was fuming about a meeting in her department and walked to the lab with angry steps, Alex told her, "Calm down." No doubt the same expression had in the past been aimed at Alex's own excitable self. Other famous cases include Coco, the sign language gorilla spontaneously combining the signs for white and tiger upon seeing a zebra, and Washo, the chimpanzee pioneer of this entire field, labeling a swan a water bird. I am prepared to interpret this as a hint of deeper knowledge, but only after I see more evidence than we have today. It is good to keep in mind that these animals produce hundreds of signs every day and have been studied for decades. We'd need to know more about the ratio between hits and misses among the thousands of utterances recorded. How are these fortuitous combinations different from, say, Paul the Octopus, nicknamed Pulpo Paul, who rose to fame after a string of correct predictions during the 2010 World Cup? In the same way that no one assumes that Paul knew much about soccer, he was just a lucky mollusk, we need to compare striking animal utterances with the probability of them coming about by chance. It is hard to evaluate linguistic skills if we never get to see the raw data, such as unedited videotapes, and hear only cherry-picked interpretations by loving caretakers. It also doesn't help that whenever apes produce wrong answers, their interpreters assume that they have a sense of humor, exclaiming, "Oh, stop kidding around," or, "You funny gorilla." Upon the death of Robin Williams in 2014, when the whole country was grieving one of the world's funniest men, Coco was said to be mourning, too. It sounded plausible, especially since the Gorilla Foundation in California called Williams one of her closest friends. The problem is that the two of them had met just once, 13 years before, and that the only evidence of Coco's somber reaction was a photo of her sitting with her head down and eyes closed, which was hard to distinguish from a dozing ape. I found the grieving claim to be a huge stretch, not because I doubt that apes have